Global leaders are meeting this week in Glasgow, Scotland for the COP26 Climate Summit. Some big promises have come out of the conference so far, including a pledge to cut methane emissions by a third by 2030 and a pledge to end deforestation the same year. Gregory Nemet is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's author of the book, How Solar Energy Became Cheap, A Model for Low Carbon Innovation. Gregory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, good, Rob. It's good to be here.
Before we get to some of the specifics out of this, how hard is it to get a whole bunch of countries to get together and agree and commit to a measurable change that's going to have an impact on climate change?
Well, I'll give you one answer to that is we've been working on it for more than 30 years and we're not quite there yet. So it's not because we haven't wanted to do something about it. It's not because we didn't know it's a big problem. It's because it's hard to get agreement on, you know, almost 200 countries representing almost 8 billion people with a lot of, you know, different preferences on what they want from their lives. And so what we need is cooperation, and that's been hard, but we are making progress.
Here we have this methane emission agreement, including European Union, the United States, ends up with about 100 countries plus actually saying we're going to cut methane emissions 30% by the year 2030. Can you explain the significance of that and the focus on methane?
Yeah, methane, which we often think of as natural gas, so that's what a lot of us use to cook with our stoves, that's a substantial amount of the greenhouse gases that we put into the atmosphere. So it's not the most. CO2 or carbon dioxide is the most common, but it's about 18%. But it's been one that has been growing quickly and harder to change than it has been for CO2. So to actually do something substantial with large participation, like you said, 100 countries, is a big deal. And, you know, it has the potential to have a bigger impact in the short term because methane doesn't last in the atmosphere as long as CO2 does. So it's pretty substantial and kind of a novel effort here. So it is kind of a breakthrough compared to some of the more incremental progress in other areas.
And as I'm hearing it from the Biden administration, Gregory, one of the ways the U.S. would hit that target is plugging leaks? One of our big methane sources is leaks from the natural gas supply system?
We drill a lot of holes. We have drilled a lot of holes over the last 100 years looking for oil, looking for natural gas. And once that oil is extracted, there's often gas with it. Or once the gas is extracted, we aren't as careful plugging it up as we are of making the hole in the beginning. And so, yeah, there's lots of leakage throughout the system. And a lot of it, as you say, is from abandoned or non-productive oil and gas wells. But there's other places, too, like pipelines across the country. And then even the distribution systems that go to almost every one of our 100 million households in the U.S. has a natural gas line. And those leak all a little bit, and it adds up. And a little bit of leakage makes a big difference because methane is such a powerful greenhouse gas. So, yeah, the oil and gas wells and these other parts of the leakages could make a big impact there. And the Biden administration thinks we can do something like 70% reduction just by being more careful, just by, you know, not thinking about natural gas as something that's not that valuable, that just goes away, and thinking about it actually does damage to us, to humanity, once it gets up into the atmosphere.
I've seen the phrase, before we move on from methane, the phrase low-hanging fruit used a few times in reference to this idea that, plugging leaks and things like that can make a measurable difference.
Right. It's not high technology. It's doing things just carefully in a lot of different places. But, you know, the upside of that is there's a lot of jobs that will be associated with doing that, with maintaining these lines and improving, getting rid of the leakage throughout the system. So there's a potential for economic opportunity in addition to the climate benefits.
Talking to Gregory Nemet, professor, UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at deals, agreements reached in this week's International Climate Summit in Scotland. A piece of news you've been following, I understand, Gregory, India pledged to hit net zero emissions by 2070. What a big country, a lot of people there. What's the significance of that commitment?
It's significant for the two things you said: big country, a lot of people, also growing quickly, also burns a lot of coal, and also did not have a commitment to reduce its emissions. And that's different from all the other big emitters like the U.S., the EU. Even China has a target for getting to net zero, for, in their case, 2060. So for India to actually come and say they're going to have a target was actually a surprise. And I think that reflects a lot of effort and diplomacy that's happened over the last 12 months. So that's a big deal. And just today, India itself could make the difference of maybe half a degree or maybe a little bit less than that, of avoided warming. And so what India does makes a huge difference, because they're about 20 years behind where China has been in terms of building infrastructure, modernizing, and becoming a big consumer of energy. And so if India decides to do that in a low carbon way with access to modern technologies like solar and wind and electric vehicles, that makes a big difference. So yeah, I'm glad you highlighted that one, because India getting to net zero by 2070 would make a big difference.
Is this a hard sell for the industrial world to make for still industrializing countries like India, who could say, hey, you guys got to use all the coal you wanted in your industrial revolution. We're trying to do that now. Why did you get to do that and we don't? Do people make that sort of justice argument?
They've been making that argument for quite a while. And I think what's happened, and this is really probably one of the reasons I'm most optimistic now compared to 5 or 10 years ago, is that's a weaker argument now. And it's weaker not because we don't care about developing countries developing and attaining the lifestyles that we have and going beyond that. But it's different because now there are alternatives to develop in a way that is low carbon, that doesn't have to deal with fossil fuels of oil and gas and coal. And it's about this dramatic cost reductions we've seen in solar power, in wind power, and increasing with batteries that help for wind and solar to work when it's not sunny and windy, but also allow us to use transportation, renewable energy for transportation. And those three technologies, wind, solar, batteries, and then digitalization that connects it all together, those were not affordable and would have, as you said, been kind of a sacrifice and a more expensive way to develop. But that's not true today. So now in a lot of countries, including developing countries, the cheapest way to make electricity is with solar, period. And so that starts to really change things. And I think India sees that as well. And then it also has these co-benefits. They're super important, of health co-benefits, that if you go to any of the large cities in India, become immediately apparent. And so that's an even bigger near-term incentive to clean up their electricity and develop in a low carbon way, because they don't have to worry about things like air pollution of, you know, kids going to hospitals with asthma and bronchitis that we have in this country and increasingly happening in cities in the developing world too. And so you get that benefit in a local and near-term way, as well as the climate benefits.
I know it's easy to focus on ways that the world is falling short on climate change efforts, the still changing climate. What kind of positive developments, though, would you point us toward over the past, say, 5-10 years?
I'll say four. One I just talked about, technology, makes a huge difference. That's really opened up a lot of possibility. The second is that people are much more mobilized and aware of climate damages today. And some of that is for bad reasons, because the climate is getting worse. But some of it is for positive reasons, that we're seeing people care, people vote, people organize, and especially the youth. That has really become an international, connected, and highly mobilized group of people that are growing up, becoming more politically savvy, starting to run for office, definitely voting. And so that's another part. I think that we've had almost 90% of the world's emissions with the India development you mentioned now have committed to net zero. That wasn't true 5 years ago. And so, you know, there's a lot more to be said in terms of whether those commitments turn into real action and policy. But that's a big step, as we're actually talking about a zero carbon world in the next 30 to 40 years. And then the fourth thing I would say is there actually is evidence of countries implementing policies and reducing emissions. And some of the work I've been looking at shows that it's more than 24 countries have actually reduced their emissions over at least a 10-year period of time. And so there are models for this working, which don't involve a lot of sacrifice, don't involve compromise, and lead to a lot of increases in inclusive well-being that I think people will want to emulate. And with the technologies available today, there's a lot more examples for other cities and other countries to follow. So there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic, even though this is a daunting problem and we're behind and the climate is getting worse. But there are a lot of things going in the right direction.
And just in our last minute, I want to touch on another commitment. A lot of countries committed to ending deforestation by the year 2030. How significant do you see that?
There's a lot of carbon in forest. And some of the work that I and others do think about ways that we could have forests retain more carbon. But if we're cutting down forests to expand agriculture or to expand space for urban settlements, that's going in the wrong direction. That's taking carbon that's locked up in the trunks of trees and the roots of trees and putting into the atmosphere, either by letting the trees decay or burning them. And so that's exactly the opposite of what we want to do. And so to actually say we're going to end forest loss in this decade goes in the right direction. I think notably what's important here is who's involved. And it's countries that have some of the biggest forests in the world, like Russia, or some of the most important, like Brazil, and then another big actor, China. And they've all signed on to this ending deforestation by 2030. And so like all of the commitments at this Scotland meeting, you know, we'll see what happens in terms of real policies and how they're implemented and all the accounting and the verification. That will all matter. Mm-hmm. But the fact that these big countries have agreed to this is a step in the right direction. And
thanks to our guest, Gregory Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School, looking at climate change commitments. Tomorrow on Central Time, a rise in cigarette sales. Why? What does it mean? That's tomorrow here on Central Time.